Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Laura Meisner, and I'm with USAID's Office of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance as our Economic Recovery and Markets Advisor. And I am so excited to be introducing today's webinar. Obviously, as you all know, in today's world, we have multiple long-term protracted crises of displacement. We have recurrent natural disasters and complex crises. In the midst of all this, SEEP, the Small Enterprise Education and Promotion Network, is revising its minimum economic recovery standards, which have been a sphere companion since 2011. They lay forth the minimum level of assistance that should be provided to help markets and livelihoods come back after a crisis. So today we're going to be discussing the standards and learning from field experience and applying them. We have a terrific lineup of speakers. We'll be hearing about lessons on what it takes to do an effective economic recovery response and informing the revision of the standards. Our moderator today is Sarah Ward with the SEEP Network. She's the lead technical advisor for the Minimum Standards Initiative. She's a post-conflict and disaster market system specialist with more than 17 years of experience using market development approaches in some of the world's most challenging contexts. She's currently an independent consultant supporting economic resilience and recovery, and recently was the technical advisor for enterprise development at the International Rescue Committee, as well as the director of market development for Mercy Corps. She's spent many years in West Africa, coastal West Africa, Benin, and has worked really across Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. We also have William Wallace here with us today. He's a senior program associate at SEEP, and he's responsible for managing the Standards Initiative. Together with the steering committee and the practitioners network, he promotes widespread use and adoption of the standards and coordinates its training and capacity building. He's over 10 years of experience in humanitarian response and economic development and has a master's degree from the Institute of Social Studies in The Hague and a bachelor's from the University of Maryland. We have two speakers with us from Catholic Relief Services, CRS. Dina Brick is the head of CRS's food security and markets team. And she supports CRS programs responding to emergencies with market-based approaches, including cash and vouchers. She works on all aspects of programming and implementation, as well as trainings and assessments, and has over 10 years of experience in agriculture, environment, and food security. She has a master's degree from Fletcher at Tufts University. Also from CRS is William Martin. He's a specialist in economic recovery in very challenging contexts and works on market-based and cash transfer programs for CRS around the globe. He's also responsible to analyze the market impact of humanitarian crises and of relief efforts for mainstreaming protection and for adhering to humanitarian standards. He has a master's degree from the Sorbonne and has more than 8 years of experience working on cash and vouchers, livelihoods, microfinance, and food security programming. Finally, last but certainly not least, we have Vi Krishnan from Mercy Corps. She has more than 10 years of experience working on conflict and disaster in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. Currently, she works with Mercy Corps in the Middle East, focused on the Syria response, and recently managed Mercy Corps' GSMA award-winning Tabanco program in the Philippines, which worked to build resilience for 25,000 disaster-affected households after Typhoon Haiyan by providing them with access to mobile bank accounts. With that, I am going to turn it over to Sarah, who will provide a bit more in-depth discussion and overview of the topic. Sarah?
Good morning, everybody. I now can see that I have the mic. I wanted to thank Laura for the introductions. And I also wanted to start out the morning with a bit of a story. I have been working, as Laura said, in this field for a long time, and I have been involved with the standards for a very long time, basically since their inception. And I'd like to start out back in 2002 when I was living in Koidu in Sierra Leone. And I was working in refugee camps, and I was working very specifically during part of 2002, in Zerikoi, in Guinea. And in that refugee camp, which was one of these sort of the old-fashioned ones, which some of you may remember, which are the huge camps with hundreds of thousands of people, you know, off in the bush. And we started a loan program. And back in 2002, this was sort of revolutionary. People thought we had lost our mind. So we started lending to refugee populations, and they were paying us back. And people were totally flabbergasted. And this was sort of the start of this for me professionally. But what we were doing, we had to have a lot of conversations with our colleagues. We had to spend a lot of time working with camp authorities. We had to spend a lot of time working with our colleagues in the humanitarian sector, making sure that there was some consensus and understanding about having refugee and crisis and conflict-affected populations able to function in and be actors in their own financial decision-making process and create livelihoods for themselves by making financial decisions with funds that they had access to. And this was very, very hard for people to understand and accept. And that was, for me, the start of really working with the standards and thinking about the standards of economic recovery. We have moved so far, I think, in the past years, since sort of the 2000s to now, where, as you're going to hear today from CRS and from Mercy Corps, that not only are we sort of doing lending programs, which weren't even sort of financial programs, they were really just straight up lending programs in refugee camps, but we're now linking people in crisis-affected and conflict and disaster-affected environments right directly into financial services so they can be the actors and decision-makers in their own recovery. And we're also looking at all of this in with a different lens, with a resilience lens. So there's a lot that has changed. The standards, which we're going to hear about from our presenters today, have hopefully been really played a role in their decision-making process, and played a role in the way that they've been able to implement their programs in the field. I want to just tell another quick story. A colleague of mine who was working in an East African country, which will remain nameless, was working on a market support program and was having a difficult time justifying the fact that she was working in this market support program with traders and wholesalers to the government. And she was working very closely with the government, and she was having a very difficult time connecting the work that she was doing in a market support program to their understanding of how you can support poor farmers in their country. And she eventually brought in a copy of the MERS handbook and said, "Sir, I realize that this is difficult, and I realize that you are having a hard time understanding what I'm talking about, but this is some industry-proven work that we're doing here. This work in the humanitarian sector has come under consensus, and we as the humanitarian community have developed a consensus around the market support program, about working at different levels in markets to be able to support people up and down the chain." And she was really able to use the standards and the fact that it was a consultative process to help her with a platform and have a leg to stand on, really. And I'm hoping that the standards are going to do that for all of us, in addition to providing us with a check to make sure that we're doing things in an appropriate way and a way of accessing the knowledge and work that all of us have done over the many years. As Laura mentioned, we are in the process of revising the standards. So they've been through an initial work, which was in 2009, and then they went through a revision a number of years later. And now they are going through a revision process, which is launching right now. And I'm hoping that there's such a great community here on this webinar, and we've had such great experiences, which we're going to hear about from Dina and William and Vi, about using the standards in the field, that I'm really excited to have all of you participate in this revision process. The standards have been and always will be a practitioner-led process of establishing our own guidelines and our own best practices. So I'm really looking forward to working with you on this revision process and really folding in a lot of this new work we're going to hear about. So we're going to hear about cash transfer programs. There are new financial systems. There's all sorts of new technology and ICT that is coming into the financial services sector in these places we work that needs to be folded in so that the standards are really reflecting the current practice and responding to the current practice. And I'm really excited to go through that process with you. So I am going to not take too much more time because I know our presenters have some great work to share with us. In this process, we are going to be taking questions in the chat, as we usually do, and myself and my colleagues will be sort of logging those questions and, and keeping track of them. And at the end of the session, we'll have a time where we'll start feeding those questions to our presenters. And Joy, obviously, and William, who are in the room there, will help us do that. If for some reason we miss your question, we apologize. That rolling chat window is sometimes hard to keep track of. So just ask it again. Don't feel it was ignored at all. It's probably just a technical glitch. And I will now turn it over to our presenters. Thanks so much.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Sarah. Well, I wanted to give a little bit of background, and just by looking at the group, I see there are a lot of people with plenty of experience on economic recovery, but we've been talking about a lot of things that I wanted to provide a little bit of additional background on the minimum economic recovery standards, for those of you who are not familiar with them. The SEEP Network is a global network of practitioner organizations dedicated to combating poverty through promoting inclusive markets and financial systems. We have 133 members, mostly NGOs working in mostly enterprise development and micro-enterprise originally, and we've also been changing our membership to include a lot of, I would say, organizations from the global south, including national-level microfinance associations. And SEEP is the platform where practitioners come together to share experiences. Out of the SEEP network, out of a working group of the SEEP network, a group of practitioners came together to establish these minimum economic recovery standards, which we call MERS. At the time, MERS was not associated with a global pandemic, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome. So that's one of the things we need to think about when we're revising the standards in terms of how we call it and the acronym they're using, but we'll refer to the standards as MERS. Just to give you a brief overview of the standards, they were first published in 2009. You can see the cover of the first edition. This was the result of a collaborative writing process. The first edition had a broad consultative process, brought together over 30 organizations, I'd say about several dozen practitioners who had been working in different contexts to come together and write and work on these drafts. And it was field tested in a series of different locations in Jordan, in Ecuador, in Kenya, Indonesia. We also had workshops in London. So out of this collaborative process, we published the first minimum standards for economic recovery after crisis in 2009. The 2010 edition that followed was an improvement to that 2009 edition, and it also included a wider consultative process. So we thought that we had laid the foundation for the standards. We pretty much had the core standards, and the technical standards were defined in the first edition, but then we felt it needed a little bit more work, so we invited more people. We invited people from academia, and over 63 humanitarian agencies and non-governmental organizations were involved, and over 100 practitioners gave feedback and comments to these to the final publication of the MERS handbook. As Sarah mentioned, we are now working on a new revision process, which we are now launching, which will include a broad consultative process with a write shop, 4 regional consultations, and we're planning a consultation in Asia Pacific, Africa, Latin America, and in the Middle East. And also we want to do an online consultation, and if we can, also through all the different organizations that are involved, to hold some informal workshops with their staff to talk about the standards and how we can make them better. So this third edition, we are expecting to have it at the end of next year. And as Laura mentioned, we were recognized as a SPHERE Companion Standard in 2011, and I wanted to give a tiny little bit of background on this. SPHERE is the Humanitarian Charter and Minimum Standards in Humanitarian Response. Their aim is to improve the effectiveness of humanitarian assistance, and they provide the minimum technical requirements in areas such as WASH, food security, shelter, and health. Now, the SPHERE Board at one point decided that instead of adding chapters to the handbook in areas that were not covered in what we call the life-saving core standards and technical chapters of the SPHERE handbook, they decided that instead of adding more to the actual handbook, which would make it a 500-page document, that they would accept companion standards that provided in-depth minimum standards on areas not covered by SPHERE. So from the very beginning of the process of establishing these minimum economic recovery standards, SPHERE was involved, and they also helped us to design the process, and that's why we follow their same format, which I'll be talking about a little bit more in terms of the core standards and the technical standards, as well as the way that we structure the handbook. So MERS is one of four companions, and it's the one focused on economic recovery and livelihoods. Now, why were the standards needed? Like we said, practitioners were coming back after working in Indonesia after the tsunami. They were coming back from Afghanistan, from working in Haiti. And they really felt the need to have a common understanding on how to facilitate and support livelihoods, enterprises, and economies in the wake of a crisis. Practitioners were seeing that affected populations depend on markets and require sources of income to survive and to thrive. What practitioners were sharing is that economies continue to function even under the most severe circumstances. So even in places like Sudan, even in areas that are experiencing the calamities of war, you had people showing that they had to make an income, and they were showing all these very innovative strategies and coping strategies. So the need to support these strategies. The other key message was that the traditional way of delivering aid through in-kind donations created market distortions. So when we were shipping in sacks of rice, it was affecting local farmers. So what was the focus of the standards? The focus of the standards was basically to help organizations working in humanitarian assistance to improve their strategies and interventions to improve the income, cash flow, asset management, and growth of these crisis-affected households. The standards were developed in a way that it includes the entire project cycle, from the initial assessment of the affected markets, enterprises, and households, through the program design, development, and implementation, to the impact monitoring and knowledge management. Now, just like SPHERE, there's been a lot of discussion around the handbook. The handbook can only be revised every so often, and we want it to be a living document and to share experiences as much as we can. So what we've done is we've created some resources that are available in addition to the handbook. So these include a website, which we call MERS in Action, which is a website where we post webinars and blogs that are mostly written and shared by the practitioners that are part of our network, and we also announce training events. And we've also launched an e-learning course that is now available on Disaster Ready and the International Federation of the Red Cross knowledge learning platform. Now, the audience of the standards is really practitioners. At first, we were talking about practitioners with experience in humanitarian situations, less familiar with economic recovery, practitioners' experience in economic development, let's say your value chain, economic development folks that are not accustomed to working in crisis environments, and overall practitioners working with vulnerable populations. Now, I wanted to give a very brief review of how the standards work, and then leave space for our panelists, which will be talking about actual work that they're doing in the field. But just for those of you who are not really familiar with the standards, we use the same format as SPHERE, as I mentioned, and we have standards. Each standard has its standard, key action, key indicator, and guidance notes. Now, the standards are qualitative in nature, and they specify the minimum level to be attained. And I'm going to give you the example of the financial services standard. And I'm actually using this standard in particular, and I would invite you all to download the handbook, or if you have a copy of the handbook, to look at the financial services standard. And I'm mentioning this one because this is one where we particularly think we need to revise. I think there's been a lot of changes in terms of digital payments. There's so much going on now in terms of cash transfers. So this has some major implications in terms of current practice. So this is one standard that we really want to invite you to discuss and look at it. And it's obviously something that is at the core of the SEEP Network's work. So the financial services standard looks at good financial services practice. And just to give you an example of a key action, it says necessary activities and inputs to meet the standards. Now, the actual standard says that financial service providers adhere to good accepted financial services practice. The key action, which is a necessary activity to meet the standard, is to verify whether relevant local laws, regulations, and customs are conducive to good financial service practice. Now, this is a really key first action when you're going to be thinking about financial services? Now, let's think about, for instance, areas where the local laws will not allow interest and where you're going to need Sharia-compliant financial services, for example, or areas when we've talked with some of the people working in the Syrian refugee crisis, for instance, where you want to provide financial services to the refugees, but the local laws in the host country, like Lebanon, do not allow you to do so. So this first key action, it tells you, verify local laws and regulations before you do that. Then you have key indicators, which signal whether a minimum standard has been attained. Now, the key indicator in the financial services standard, talks about the, the key indicators signal whether a minimum standard has been attained, and in this case, it talks about the long-term financial services. Now, this is an important discussion that we're going to want to get into in terms of cash, because the standards actually say that if you're going to be providing financial services, you should be thinking about the long-term. Do you have the capacity, the institutional capacity, to provide long-term financial services? And if you don't, you should work through local partners. So the guidance notes, and I think about the guidance notes as having the handbook, when you look at the guidance notes, it's like having your own senior advisor to give you some practical advice on what to do and what not to do when you're designing a program. So the guidance notes, in this case, tell you to work through local partners. And in the example that we're going to be looking at from Nepal, they've been working with cooperatives, for instance, or sometimes you work with the traders. So it depends on the context, but this is just an example of how the standards work, and I'm looking at the example of the financial standards. I'm seeing a note here, that there was a few slides that my slides started to move by themselves, but we've sorted that out. In terms of what is included in the actual handbook, as you can see, financial services is just one of those technical standards. We have four technical standards: financial services, which I was just talking about. Productive assets looks at mostly managing assets, but also protecting assets. How do you prevent people from selling off their livestock in the event of a crisis? How do you stop people from selling a female-headed household woman from selling her sewing machine? Employment creation looks at cash for work, for example, and in enterprise development will look more at the value chain type of activities. Then you have the core standards such as do no harm and the assessment analysis standards, which we've heard are very useful to practitioners. So how can MERS help you in your work? What we've heard from surveys, a lot of the feedback that we've gotten from practitioners that are using it, is that it really helps in planning and designing economic recovery programs. They felt that the indicators are also useful in helping to design their M&E. Assessment and analysis has been very useful. There's a lot of tools out there, the RAMs and the MAGs, for assessment, but the MERS assessment and analysis standards give you some very, very practical advice that has been really useful in terms of preventing assessment fatigue, who do you talk to when you're doing an assessment, these kinds of very basic things, but that are key to a good assessment. You know, working with other people, making sure you're not duplicating efforts. And then the technical standards, which go deeper into these technical areas that I just mentioned. Another nice thing about the standards is it has these text boxes that includes case studies, which are examples of what we call standard responsive practice, but also poor programming, which helps us to avoid repeating mistakes of the past. So you have these little text boxes that show you, this is what we did when we were responding after the tsunami in Aceh, and we gave out these boats that nobody used. Don't do that. So these kinds of examples are something that we also want to include in the new one, which the example that we'll be looking at with more recent work from Nepal and the high-end response, these are all lessons learned that we want to capture, and we want to see them in the third edition of the handbook. So in terms of what practitioners are saying, and you'll hear it directly from Vi, Dean, and William, who are practitioners out in the field who have been using the standards, but just to give you some additional examples, Sarah was mentioning earlier this idea of changing mindsets, and how the standards can help you also to advocate with some people who might not really understand what we're doing. So we've heard, for instance, from people in Mercy Corps, Ethiopia, that they've said, well, this has been a really useful tool for advocating for the government. Governments didn't understand the work that they were doing in terms of supporting market actors. In Guatemala, we heard one participant saying, you know, it really helps in the case where you have beneficiaries who have been used to handouts. You know, they're not really understanding why we're doing cash transfers. So the handbook has been helpful in changing these mindsets. We've heard from, it was nice to hear from a practitioner lately in South Africa telling me, well, yeah, I've always got the handbook on my iPad. You know, I refer to it pretty much on a regular basis. And so we've heard it has many uses. I mean, it's been used as an advocacy tool to say, you know, these are industry standards. This is what we've all agreed on. But it also is a really good tool to help you to design programs, and it helps you to really think through the process when you're designing. And I'll leave it at that, and I just wanted to give you some information. And for those of you who don't already have a copy of the standards, you can download it on the Seed Network website. It's also available for purchase on Amazon or directly from the publisher, which is Practical Action Publishing. And I just wanted also to highlight here in this picture the other standards that we work very closely with. So you'll see the Sphere Handbook, obviously, is there, but also Child Protection Minimum Standards, the Interagency Network for Education in Emergencies, and the Livestock Emergency Guidelines and Standards, which are the standards that we all work with and work very closely. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. My name is William Martin. Yes, it's my turn. So I will be the main presenter for Catholic Relief Services, and my colleague Dina will also be around. I'm happy to see some people there as participants. I know some of the names here, and I see also that our market community is growing, so thank you. And I will present today a perspective from the field, and from Nepal in particular. SIP shared early on some key standards for Nepal response, and I will show you how we apply them to our intervention. So the first earthquake, its epicenter was in West of Nepal, in Gorkha district, and that's where we intervened. And about 70% of the houses in the area had some damage, or were totally destroyed, with some villages that had up to 90% of destruction. Very early on, we deployed along our other teams, we deployed our market rapid assessment and analysis, And we proceeded very quickly a week later with the market rapid assessment and analysis along in-kind distributions. Then, as a second step, we really wanted to have people covered before the monsoon season, a month and a half later, and with other NGOs, we implemented some cash for shelter intervention. And we distributed about $150 per household to about 8,000 beneficiaries in the area. Later on, we started to work on indirect support to markets with cash grants for vendors, about $300 cash grants per vendor for about 400 vendors for market rehabilitation. Finally, we did some market multi-purpose grants, which are cash, unconditional cash programs, which was about $75 per household to about 16,000 beneficiaries. So this one was a little bit late because of coordination vision with the government. And all along we put the coordination process as well. So for the past 6 months, we helped about 25,000 beneficiaries in the area with cash and market-based response. So I will navigate you through the standards along the past 6 months of our implementation. How did CRS use them and the challenges we faced? So for the market rapid assessment, that's where the assessment and analysis standards apply from the nurse. And what we did is make use of information from existing assessment that were shared on the humanitarian response.info, real chat platform, and from other information we could gather from clusters meeting. We also made a point of understanding the pre-earthquake context and the impact of the earthquake on the levees and coping mechanism, and it was a key part of our Nepal assessment. That means we dig into census information or studies that were made before the earthquake to understand the situation prior to the earthquake and how it affected people. Very early on as well, the first week, we did like a phase one assessment to understand the CGI and the labor market, and had an integrated new assessment where we included a market section in it, an edit section. And then two or 3 weeks later, we started to gather more detailed information that we shared with the clusters and cash working group. We worked also from the outset with the Chamber of Commerce, and it was very extremely useful to be in contact with vendors and understanding the market dynamics. We also used Kobo Toolbox. It is a new like a technology to gather data that was extremely useful, also because other NGOs were using it, so we were able to share information with them and not duplicate information. And we had, of course, a gender-sensitive approach with gender-segregated information. The challenge we had was about the timing. And continually updating assessment information and making sure the program was adapted to changing market conditions. So we had to be creative about updating assessment information, as there was no time to do regular and organized assessment. But we used monitoring data, program visits, and informal discussion with traders to maintain updated information. All along the implementation, since the beginning, the market-oriented programming standard applied. We had an integrated approach from the start of the project cycle. We made sure we had the expertise to advocate for a market-oriented programming, so by sending our team, including myself and Lina, on the ground. And we made sure to build capacity of our other team members and our local partners. And very early on, we started to integrate the early recovery strategy in our intervention. So consequently, it helped us understand market dynamics to rely on them when possible. And the market analysis was an integral part of the livelihood assessment conducted in Nepal. The focus was not just on formal markets or players, but also on small retailers who play an important role in the local economy and community access to key projects important for recovery. And the scope of our market analysis also included key services such as finance and its provider. And we built early recovery strategy early on during the emergency response for good communication with all stakeholders in order for them to plan for the future and avoid vacuum. We faced some challenges, of course. And call that the new seal of cash theory. A lot of people believe that the cash will be misused because we need to build evidence. And often we have to convince among your peer that cash will be misused. So it was very interesting because even when we brought evidence that the cash wouldn't be misused because of the right targeting and because of previous studies, such as the one done by the World Bank, it was very difficult sometimes to convince other NGOs or partners or the government. For example, that's why it took some time to implement some of the activities. Also, much more challenge, but questions for the future. About when we were doing some indirect support to market, should we support formal or informal businesses? So just during emergencies, we were very pragmatic and realistic, so we supported businesses that were able to help to cover needs of people, whether they were more informal. But that's a question I think we should ask for the future. And also, maybe a question about should we support vendors of essential goods only, or all vendors, and that could help them to people than benefiting of the multiplier effect and indirect effect. So it's the same, it's not a question we address during the emergency phase, but that's something maybe we should investigate later on. Then, about the implementation, cash for shelter and cash grants for vendors and the multi-purpose grants. That's where the technical enterprise development standards apply, as well as the technical financial standards. So for the enterprise development standards, it's about sustaining program impact. Look for a leader or enterprise that could be potential partner for implementation. So what we did is we focus on opportunities where we were closely with existing value chain actors rather than put up a pilot system until absolutely required. So what we did for the CGI, for example, the corrugated iron sheets, we made sure to identify the main stakeholders along the supply chain, along the market chain, and work with them. For the financial services standards, so standards one and demand, we assessed early on through discussion with the Chamber of Commerce and field visits and rapid market assessment that there was a need for market support and the need was identified as a short term. For the standard two, about the institutional capacity to deliver appropriate financial services, CRS tried to find a local service provider through Red Rose, but it was challenging because of financial integration, about the integration of the financial system. So, but we were able to work with a local financial partner to do cash in envelope. So we wanted to transfer that because of the challenge of integration of financial system, it was difficult. But we were able still to work with a local partner to deliver cash. The other challenge regarding the implementation is NGOs are acting often as a financial service provider. We asked a question for the revision about the coverage of the minimum economic coverage standards when NGOs are acting as a service financial provider. Finally, the other challenge was the grant versus loan for the support to vendors. We noticed that the vendors were not loans ready, so we had to work with a grant approach. And finally, about the coordination, that's where the standards on standard two on coordination applied. And I would like also for this, we'll talk about the Duno on standards. So what we did, early on the same, we collaborated right away with the cash coordination group the first 2 weeks of the disaster and after, and share a lot of information with the cluster members or cash working group members about the cash visibility, the standard operating procedures for the MPG. So we worked a lot with all the other actors, and I think it was beneficial. The negotiation, communication, advocacy with the government through the UN or through the cluster was an essential piece for doing a good job on the ground, and because we have to do it, we have to communicate clearly with every actors. Gender sustainability approach and the standard context specific and evidence-based eligibility criteria. I think it's very important as well when we are communicating with other stakeholders to bring evidence to what we are doing, particularly for the area of market and cash-based response. So the challenge we faced was, working with a third working group on cash and market-based response within a cluster system. It's not necessarily well adapted. So to conclude, while some of the key lessons we need to focus on when revising the minimum economic recovery standard, the first one is that the standards when NGO is a service provider. So that's not something that is necessarily included right now, but that's something maybe to consider for the future. The second one is maybe having more common indicators, because we face some challenges at taking decision among coordination bodies. So having common indicators that are measurable and help taking faster decision among coordination body would be useful. It would help also to benchmark the effectiveness of the different market and cash-based intervention. Some recommendations on supporting formal or informal businesses. So not maybe necessarily into the minimum economic recovery standards, but maybe that should be a discussion we should have along to see what standard we want regarding the formalization of businesses when we work with and on private sector. Then targeting market support to cover only essential needs versus market blanket coverage to use trickle-down effect. So should we support, for example, vendors that are only providing essential goods to cover needs of people, or should we do market blanket coverage? Maybe that's something, again, that we should think about during discussions while evaluating the MERS. Finally, actionable recommendations for market and cash-based intervention coordination bodies for better fit with testers. So again, you know, how we can help with indicators to help taking decision quickly, but also the structure of where should the cash and market-based approach fit into the cluster system. So that's it on my side. Thank you for your attention, and I hope you will have questions. Thank you very much.
Hi, everyone. My name is Bai. Thanks, William. That was actually a really great presentation. I was in Nepal for the recovery, for the emergency as well. So it was really good to see how CRS applied the MERS standards in Nepal. I'm going to take a slightly different tack, and I'm going to talk about my experiences as a practitioner and how I use MERS as a practitioner and sort of some of the maybe top-line challenges that I face, because as William and you heard other people say, this is more about how do we as practitioners use this and how can we make it more useful in the next edition. I'm going to take you back a little bit to South Sudan, the 2011, when I was there running an economic recovery program. Maybe I shouldn't even say those words. This is a forum full of economic recovery people, so it may not be the right thing to say. But also, I want to compare a little bit and talk about the Philippines post-Typhoon Haiyan in 2013. And just to give you a brief on South Sudan, 2011 was a time when I had not been introduced to MERS yet, which is why I wanted to talk a little bit about it. South Sudan, the context of the time was that it had just become independent, and this was way back in July 2011. I was in Unity State, which is the border state between Sudan and South Sudan, and we had just received funding from OFDA to implement a demand-driven livelihoods program. Now, obviously, the time we'd written this program proposal was 6 months ago, when at the time which markets were functioning, everything was fine. I came in to start the program, markets collapsed, and literally every shop in Unity State in Bintu sold flip-flops, charcoal, or coffee. That was it. And funnily enough, all the restaurants always had beer, but they never had food, which I'm assuming is an effect of humanitarians being in country. Anyway, so in South Sudan, following that market collapse in Unity State, Mercy Corps undertook another assessment where we talked to traders, we talked to farmers, we talked to local businesses, and what we were finding more and more was that because there were so many goods coming in from Khartoum previously flooding the market, local production was literally zilch. People were cultivating for subsistence, but nothing was coming up to the market because it didn't make sense for them. So we looked at this market collapse as an opportunity to revive local production. So we decided to do it through cash transfers because we found that traders were finding other markets to buy produce from. So the market's goods coming in from Khartoum are closed, but traders are finding other ways to bring in goods. So we did this program in two locations, and I want to talk a little bit about just briefly just about what I learned from that. In one of the locations which was been to, we mobilized pharma groups, we mobilized people to form new businesses, particularly the ones that from our market assessment we were looking at were in demand. And this included, this included a solar light business, and we linked them up to D-Light, which was one of our, which was a provider based in Kenya, to be able to procure this. So we mobilized pharma groups, businesses, and provided them with cash grants. At the same time, mobilized them to form village savings groups, so access to informal financial services, to be able to continue their livelihood activities. And this, we had some mixed results from these groups. There were some groups that did fantastically well, and there were some groups which came together for the pharma groups and the businesses, but took the money and then couldn't agree on how to move forward and left. Now, this is one, and I'm going to tell you about the other experience in another county in Leh, which is also in UNC State, where we had very little access. So here we were only able to mobilize these informal financial services, these village savings groups. And towards 3 or 4 months into the formation of these groups, when we went to see them, we found that these groups, because they were not expecting any other assistance from Mercy Corps, had basically started borrowing, started some of their own small-scale livelihood activities, and started thriving. So they didn't really need us to provide them with cash grants for additional livelihood support. They'd basically done it on their own just from these village savings groups. Now, there are two things that strike me from this. One is, as I was reading MERS more recently, one of the things that it talks about there is sometimes the most vulnerable may not be the right beneficiaries for economic recovery programs. And the reason I mention this is when we talked about some of those groups that did well and some that didn't, we found that the slightly middle tier, so it was not the most vulnerable, people who were in that slightly middle tier, whether it was farmers or small businesses, when they were given the cash, were able to absorb the most vulnerable into their businesses as labor. So at the end of the day, it provided them with it created the same impact as if we were directly working with these vulnerable groups. And this is an important point to remember, because most of the times we struggle when we are talking to donors about why, especially in market recovery programs, when we're working with vulnerable groups, we want to be able to work with that mid-tier in the market as opposed to people who are subsistent, because that may not be the right groups for us to be able to work with. And all of this, as I was reading more recently, I was thinking, well, why didn't I have this in 2011, you know, because I could have used all of this knowledge and information. It would have saved me a lot of heartbreak. So I wanted to talk about my own experience of MERS and how this is, what it looks like in my day-to-day work. I'm moving slightly on to the Philippines. This is a technology-based program in response to Typhoon Haiyan. Mercy Corps decided that we were not going to phase our program into relief and recovery, but we wanted to put into place mechanisms that would provide for longer-term, more sustainable recovery for these vulnerable populations right at the very start. So we assessed the institutional capacity of our partner, Banco. We decided that they had a product offering, which was mobile banking. It had the reach that we needed. It had the agent capacity. So we decided to open mobile bank accounts for 25,000 survivors of the typhoon. We provided emergency cash transfers in 3 tranches into these bank accounts. We continued with savings encouragements, not just one-time financial training during registration, but continued engagement with people through SMS and voice recordings. And we worked with Banco to identify a gap in the financial services that people were accessing, which was a livelihood loan for recovery. And William earlier talked about NGOs becoming service providers, and my experience has been that, you know, if you do have a formal financial service provider who can be the service provider, then that's probably a better route to take in terms of buy-in and in terms of how they take that forward. So we worked with Banco to identify that this was a specific gap in the market. People were not able to access a loan to recover, but also that people were really worried about what their family was going to do if something happened to them, and their main needs were insurance. So we looked at combining loans, which was a more profitable venture for Banco, and, you know, as a private sector, if you're partnering with them, you do have to walk the walk, talk the talk. They do think about profit, and that's what makes it all so real, you know, makes it sustainable for them. So we looked at we combined livelihood loans with a one-year accident insurance, and to make sure that people were paying on time, Banco stipulated that people would be able to receive, the insurance would start ticking once people had repaid their loan in full. And Banco piloted this among Typhoon Haiyan survivors and is expanding this for other populations in that region. One of the things that strikes me when I think about South Sudan and the Philippines is this access to financial services. And I know this is one of the standards in MERS. And we do talk about institutional capacity to deliver. In the Philippines, one of the challenges we had was people's experience of the technology and how much they interact with technology and how much they are able to interact with the technology, and how can we think about that end user experience? The lady you see on this picture is Anna. How can we think about people like Anna when we think about providing financial services through technology-based programs? How do we make sure that people like Anna do not have difficulty accessing this technology to be able to gain impact from the program? So the user experience for me is varying from one location to another, and it's quite a challenge. So we do have to think about who our end users are and how do we introduce, you know, programs like this sustainably to them while creating the impact, while creating that recovery process that we want them to be a part of. As we are learning more about crisis, Mercy Corps as an agency is investing a considerable amount of resources into understanding what makes certain households cope or recover better and certain households not. What are those determinants of resilience? And as Mercy Corps, we think of resilience as the capacity to learn, to cope, to adapt, and to transform in the face of shocks and stresses. So for us as an agency, it's really important for us to understand how are people learning from these shocks and stresses? What can we learn from that process? And how are they adapting? And how can we, as an agency, as humanitarians, be able to build off of that? And this is extremely crucial as we are talking about more and more crisis today. We talk about, every time I pick up the news, sometimes I don't want to read it because it's all about, we talk about South Sudan, there's Yemen, there's Syria, there's so many crises, there's forgotten crises. People have forgotten about there are so many emergencies that people have even forgotten some of these. And as we compete for space in the media, how do we make sure that we are more effectively responding to these populations? How do we make sure that we are building their resilience? And I want to talk about very briefly just two findings from the Determinants of Resilience study. And just to put some caveats in, as any good humanitarian should do, I am not the one who headed these research studies. These were done by our teams in Southeast Asia and with support from our research teams in HQ. And I will be able to point you to them if you have further questions about this. But very quickly on two things. I want to compare just the Philippines and Nepal just literally on two findings. One was income sources. In the Philippines, we found that households that had more diverse sources of income, for example, agriculture and commerce, they appear to be less resilient to the typhoon than those who had just one income source. Now, this seems a bit counterintuitive, but this may be because the livelihood diversification for these households is not an intentional risk management strategy, but it is more an economic need. So they are poorer, more vulnerable households. They try and diversify their income sources to be able to make ends meet. So even if They have multiple sources of income. Even if one of them is affected by the typhoon, it is going to cause them to become less resilient. In Nepal, we found that maintaining or regaining livelihoods and restoring market functions were critical to improved coping and recovery. Right? So, I mean, so we talk about livelihoods, and these are just two contexts where we find how livelihoods is extremely important, and it's an important factor to consider right at the very beginning and not think about emergency relief, but start to think about livelihoods very, very early on. The other thing I want to talk about, because we keep talking about financial services. Financial services in the Philippines, we found that in both contexts, we found that financial services do matter, but here's where it's a slightly different. In the Philippines, we found that informal financial services were more important post-shock in the immediate aftermath of Yolanda, but in the longer term, formal financial services were more important. Formal savings and loans were more important in the longer term. In Nepal, and again, the caveat here is that this has been done 10 weeks after the Gorkha earthquake, and we will be repeating this study. In Nepal, we found that financial services do matter in the right form. They do matter, but credit can also do harm. But here's where it's slightly different is, and we have to take a slightly nuanced approach to this. When we looked at households that had informal credit, right? So we said drawing on informal credit after the earthquake was associated with an even bigger increase in distressful coping mechanisms. But drawing formal credit had an important positive impact. So when we looked at this, we said those who accessed credit pre-earthquake were probably more likely to be in debt prior to the earthquake, and that's why they probably had worse coping strategy scores. So as we look at financial services, as we look at livelihoods, as we look at different crises, what we are beginning to understand is that we need a lot more information to be relevant to the programming that we do, and we no longer can afford to look at, I'm going to leave you with a last few thoughts from my side, the whole the relief, recovery, development phase, we no longer can afford to look at these in these different phases. I was talking to a colleague of mine who works on a program in Ethiopia, and she said when I think about economic recovery, I think about a post-humanitarian crisis situation. And to me, that's a bit funny, because a few years ago, I would have thought about economic recovery as that next step after emergency. And I think this is where the lines start to blur. As we talk about resilience, at some point in time, we used to talk about disaster risk reduction. But to me, is disaster risk reduction pre-crisis? What resilience is post-crisis? And how can we kind of learn from that? We are finding, even in locations like Syria, that markets and communities are adapting to the crisis. MercyCorps did an assessment recently inside Syria to understand how local farmers were adapting to the crisis. And this report is also available. But basically, the farmers have moved from cultivating wheat to cultivating coriander, not in large quantities, but they have started cultivating coriander, which is, which they're able to sell in the open market to traders. And for some reason, inside Syria, we're fine. I'm being a little bit non-specific about which locations in Syria, and forgive me for doing that, but inside Syria, in some locations, we're finding shops that have Pepsi and Pringles. So if Pepsi and Pringle are getting through, what is that value chain? What are those traders? What does those networks look like? And what can we as humanitarians learn from how these markets and communities are adapting to this crisis? And how can we then bring that into economic recovery programming to make it more relevant? I don't know if we want to be sitting here 5 years down the line and saying, well, we need to revise the standards again, but we need to think of how can we make this more relevant to practitioners to be able to continue to learn, to have that space to learn from from all the new developments that are happening. Thank you very much. I'm done talking.